The views and comments expressed on The Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on The Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Live from the Space Talk Radio Studios, it's The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting live to four continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy, here's the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, Space Show listeners. Welcome to The Space Show. I hope all of you had a great July 4th holiday weekend if you're here in the United States. And for those of you outside the States, I hope you also had a great weekend wherever you are. And it's nice to be back, and thank you for joining with us tonight. A couple of quick announcements right on to our show. First of all, if you are in the greater Seattle area for the first hour of the show, if you would like to call and talk to our guest or give us comments, that number is 425-373-5527. For everyone else and for the full show, which is 90 minutes, it's an MCI toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Those of you who would rather talk with us, share your ideas with us via email, use one of three addresses, dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or thespaceshow@gmail.com. And for those of you that prefer chat, use either Instant Messenger, ICQ, or CompuServe, and the screen name is the same for all of them, Space Show Chat. Don't forget to visit the message board at spaceinvestor.com, and we thank Ken for making that available. And visit our website, thespaceshow.com. The comprehensive detailed newsletter is there. Also, you can subscribe to the abbreviated weekly newsletter. Both come out on Monday. Just send an email to the drspace@thespaceshow.com address. All of our programs since January are in the MP3 format. Since May, they're being podcast. You will find the RSS feed URL on each of the newsletters and on the main website page. So you're free to download those shows and do anything you want with them other than something commercial. Visit the Space Show store, and also while you're at our site, click on the Support the Space Show button. It's been a big help to us in providing all of the services and features that the Space Show is doing, and so we appreciate anything and everything that you do. And through that service, we're going to be announcing some very big and very significant changes for the Space Show, probably within the next 60 days, so stay tuned for that. Well, I am thrilled, and I know you are going to be thrilled, too, to have one of the best ever and the brightest returning guests to the Space Show that the Space Show has been fortunate to have on in its close to 360 shows. Our guest today is Tim Pickens, and I wish he were here just about every week because he is talking sense about business, talking sense about rockets, has his own program, his own business, Orion Propulsion, which he is the president of and the founder of, and it's located in Huntsville, Alabama. And it's always great to be talking with Tim. He has over a decade of experience in the aerospace industry, and he has worked with multiple programs as an engineer and developer. Most notably, he worked with Burt at Scaled Composites, leading in-house propulsion on Spaceship One, which everyone knows was the first privately funded suborbital manned space plane. He also led the development of a hybrid rocket vehicle with the Huntsville, Alabama L5 Society, which is now the local chapter of the National Space Society. This vehicle became the world's highest flying amateur rocket, achieving an altitude of 36 miles as documented in the Guinness Book of World Records 2000 edition. He was recently featured in Popular Mechanics with his daughter Sarah and their rocket bikes, something I sure wish I had. Boy, would that be fun. He was also featured on the Discovery Channel in Canada this May for his work at Orion, the Burt Rutan work, and for the rocket bikes. This interview also appeared on their website under the Daily Planet section. On the technical side, Mr. Pickens is working on new innovations for reusable flyback boosters, Orion recently submitted a proposal for the hybrid launch vehicle program. This concept is a highly responsive vehicle, launch turnaround time of 24 to 48 hours, and will reduce the cost of what is currently available by a factor of 3 to 6. His company is currently developing igniters and RCS thrusters for the T-Space crew vehicle, and Orion is also responsible for the design and construction of Air Launch's 20K thrust stand, as well as a future thrust stand rated at 200K. The Orion team has been actively supporting hot fire testing in Mojave of Air Launch's 20K motor to be used as the upper stage engine on the Quick Reach vehicle, which is being developed by the DARPA and Air Force on a program known as Falcon. And he pays attention to business fundamentals. So without further ado, welcome back to the Space Show. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing well. I appreciate you having me back on. It's going to be a lot of fun talking about what we're doing and what we plan to do here in the near future. So I appreciate you having me back.
Well, it's my pleasure, my honor, really and truly. And start out and tell us what you're doing and what's happening. The last time you were on, you were working on the engine with, for Spaceship One, and I think you had just become a outside contractor with SpaceDev or something, and it was almost complete or was complete.
Right. That's right. I finished up. I became a consultant, and then that's when Dave Thompson took over my role, and Dave later had got killed there in a plane crash, and I believe it was a Boa Strait took on the role as propulsion guy in the house. So he was leading the two teams, the EAC approach and the SpaceDev approach. So I became a consultant, and I was there supporting some engine test firings, as well as I was there witnessing some test flights and the final flights that led to the winning of the X Prize.
Did it perform exactly as you thought it would, or were there surprises for you?
Well, there's some days you work a program like that where you think, boy, this is pretty wacky. Is this really going to work? And other days you'd say, hey, this is pretty cool. That, I'll stick to the rockets. Bert can stick to the wings. And maybe at the end of the day, we'll both know what we're doing and maybe it'll work. So what happened is, with that philosophy, Bert said one time, he says, you're doing pure research if half the people that are working for you don't believe it can be done. He said, that's when you know you're pushing the edge. And he said, so it's not uncommon not to believe in what you're doing every day. But as a whole, it was just a very, very awesome program to be part of. And I was very fortunate to have been asked to come to work and help out.
And so now you have Orion, and I read a few of the things that you're involved in. So tell us exactly what you're doing.
Okay, well, basically, there's a program going with the military, the DARPA folks, where it's they're looking for a way to have a responsive space capability that's very low cost, possibly to be able to put a 1,000 pounds to LEO for $5 million. Basically, one of the teams that I'm helping out is known as the Air Launch. It's been a very interesting program. Basically, they're using a two-stage rocket that uses liquid oxygen and propane, and very innovative approach, very low parts count vehicle. Basically, it's being air launched from a C-17 cargo plane. It'll be dropped out of the back, and it'll be uprighted using some clever chute deployment techniques and whatnot. And basically, it'll be uprighted, and it'll fire the first stage and second stage, and be able to carry things to the low Earth orbit. It's called a quick reach. What the name of the rocket is. So we were asked to design a test facility, a test stand that's portable, that could do up to 20,000 pounds of thrust. And basically, we had to do the data acquisition control system, as well as all the plumbing and basically all the facility valves and everything you need to measure thrust, take data, you know, all the measurements are typical of a hot fire test. So we've done that, and we're currently designing a test facility, a vertical test facility for the first stage that'll test up to 200,000.
Hold it right there. This is where we're going to pause for our first break. We're going to be back in about 2 minutes. Our guest today is Tim Pickens.
The Space Show thanks its listeners and sponsors for their support. Having a spacefaring society and culture is not only important, it's crucial for humanity. It is also a large undertaking for everyone involved in this mission, and the Space Show is no exception. So join with us by visiting www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Please make a contribution which will help us in continuing to bring you our programming and services, all free of charge. The Space Show also has available opportunities for advertising and sponsorship on air, the archived programs, the newsletter, and the website. For information, contact Dr. Livingston at drspace@thespaceshow.com or 415-435-6018. Again, The Space Show thanks you for listening and for your support.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back to The Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston. Our guest today is Tim Pickens. And Tim, just before the break, you were talking about air launch, and in a way I want to interrupt you because Elon Musk was on not too long ago, and he was asked by a listener why he chose vertical launch to deal with range fees and all of the nonsense he has to go through, and now he's going to be moving it out to Kwajalein to launch instead of doing air launch. And his reply was, I'm doing really big rockets with massive payloads, and you just can't do that with air launch. It's for much smaller payloads, much smaller rockets. I really didn't have any choice but to go vertical launch because of the capabilities of vertical over air launch. So I'm talking generically now for air launch, not air launch LLC. Was Elon on the right track with that?
Well, it does seem to make sense for the current aircraft that are out there today that can swing, you know, like a large diameter type of vehicle. And I know Elon's wanting to do a Falcon 5, I think he calls it,
right,
that vehicle, and it's going to be really big. And
well, bigger than that, he talked about on the show going up to Falcon 6, Falcon 7 after Falcon 5.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, it probably does make a lot of sense for him right now for his size vehicle, but you know, the thing about it is, if you look at companies like T-Space, who are working with Scale Composites, they're one of our team members, and basically those guys are willing to build a large aircraft that'll take up a very large vehicle, which is actually the CXV is going to be an airdrop vehicle. And there are some real advantages of doing that, you know. I'll give you an example. To go down to the equator to do a launch like sea launch, the range fees for doing that, I believe, are around $10,000. I believe that's correct. I have to look at my notes. But basically, there's when you do an air launch, it gives you a lot of versatility to where you can go and do these airdrops or launches, if you will.
Right.
So I think there are some real advantages to it if you really want a lower cost. I think Kwajalein, you know, I've talked to the Kwajalein guys, and they're really eager to get out here and try to lower cost. But, you know, right now, Kwajalein really doesn't have the infrastructure to support.
Yeah, he's building
activity. Right now, you know, Elon's pouring lots of concrete. I'm sure they're importing everything.
Right.
Including they're going to have to come get some type of liquid oxygen generator on site. They don't have that yet. I believe I talked to one of the guys recently, and they said they had hoped to bring a system like that on board, you know, pretty soon to be able to do that. But, you know, and it's certainly going to be cheaper than Vandenberg, but, you know, I just don't, you know, it's logistics of getting out there to Kwajalein. It's time consuming. You know, I believe he told me they sent a barge out there about once a week. I believe that's correct.
It's a long ways out there, that's for sure.
So, but I guess there's some, if he's going with something, real large class down the road, I guess it fits his vision. So, but you know, if you know you're going to do an air launch, your vehicles start to look a little different too. For instance, you know, instead of doing a large round stack, kind of like they did the Saturn One, you might end up doing more stacks that look more like the Titan. You know, so everything's kind of laying out there on the same plane, if you will.
Uh-huh.
So you can cradle it underneath this large lift aircraft. So I think there's some real benefits of doing an airdrop. Also, it gives you some, it gives the crew quite a bit of escape time to get away from the booster when you're doing a free fall, if you will. Let's say from 35, or if you're Rutan, it may be 50,000 feet. So there are some advantages, I believe.
Well, right now the largest fixed-wing aircraft, I guess, is the Russian Antonov, which could probably be resurrected to be used.
Mm-hmm.
And actually in that paper my authors and I sent you, we addressed some of the economics of using the Antonov. But could you, how big a payload could you get in something that big? I mean, that's bigger than a C-5A.
I don't know about that particular craft, but there were basically the plans are to just take some decommissioned, you know, some Boeing aircraft and doing a, doing a white knight version of them. And with the right landing gear configuration, they were going to be able to do, basically, they were going to do the CXD vehicle and be able to put four guys in it and carry them to low Earth orbit. So they've ran those studies, and I tell you, I stood there on the flight line and talked to Bert about it about 2 months ago, and he's just, you know, he just believes it wouldn't be a big deal to do it.
Yeah, and I would imagine those Boeing jets are pretty easy to pick up.
Right.
There's a lot of them sitting out there at Mojave.
Right. As a matter of fact, we were standing on the flight line. He pointed out there, and he said, you see those two jets, and he said, we'd like to put a couple of those together and make a close to 400-foot wingspan plane. And, you know, when Bert Rutan tells you that, you believe it.
So he would put two jumbo jets together.
Basically.
That'd be an amazing thing to see fly.
So it's pretty cool, you know. If it was anybody else saying that, you'd say, well, that's pretty difficult, but I believe if Bert says it, I believe he could do it.
You certainly stand up and take note, right?
Right, absolutely.
We've got a caller on hold, Marshall from Saxe, Texas, who has some questions for you. Marshall, you still with us?
Yes, sir.
Have at it.
Okay. As usual, I try to produce several questions, but usually David chooses, so I'm going to do all three here. First question, I understand that about any solid that burns in the presence of any hot gas can be made into a hybrid rocket. What solid and what gas combination would produce the biggest bang thrust for the amount of weight?
Okay. David, I picked up on some of that. It sounded like he...
Sounds like he's in an echo chamber, but he's saying that his understanding is that you can pretty much use any solid to burn for a rocket fuel, and assuming that that's pretty much correct, what gives the biggest bang for the buck?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of folks that have burned everything from rubber to candle wax and hybrids. You're right about that, and I think you need to look at things like, obviously, ISP, specific impulses, is one of the big criteria that we use. And then there's density impulse. Of course, the specific impulse being how many pounds of thrust you can produce per pound of propellant per second. And then there's density impulse, you know, how much impulse can you get out of a given volume, if you will, or you know, how compact can you make the system to deliver that? In other words, let's say it's a hybrid. Obviously a hybrid has got a hollow port down the center or multiple hollow ports down the center, so there's a lot of volume in there that's just not used. You have to have it because that's where the oxidizer is delivered down to the core there. So there are limitations to how much stuff you can put in a motor case. So is where a solid, you may have an end burner where you utilize most all of it, or you might have a star grain or whatever. So you typically with solids, you have a lot more density impulse. You know, you might have a mass fraction on a solid rocket motor. It's not uncommon to have, say, 90% propellant. You know, is where a hybrid may only have 50% in terms of the actual rubber in the motor case. Now, you make up some of that with the oxidizer. But, if you're using, let's say, nitrous, it's not that dense of a propellant. Or an oxidizer. You know, liquid oxygen might be, say, 71 pounds a cubic foot, and where nitrous may be, say, 47, 48 pounds a cubic foot at room temperature. So it's, so obviously hybrids that use LOX are better. They're denser, but there are combustion stability issues that usually come with those using cryogenics. So I guess the answer is you can burn about anything, but some things deliver, better impulse, specific impulse than others. I give you a real common example is that roofing tar, which we used in one of the HAL 5 Club rockets, performed as well as pure rubber that you use, say, in most hybrids, HTPB. So, they both sea level with nitrous. You might deliver 205 to 215 RSP. So, their density of asphalt in many cases is a little better. It might be a specific gravity of one or better. So, I think that, some things are better than others. You might go with wax and find that if you don't burn it out really quick, in other words, consume it all in a pretty thick, quick burn, you might find that you have a lot of post-burning and the efficiency is not that good, even though you can burn it really fast. If there are issues that, at least my experience, is burning, say, candle wax. It's a pretty good fuel, but it's very difficult to control shutting it down and then later burning it without it trying to melt and change shape a little bit. And it's just, so there you go. There's from candle wax to salami to rubber, anything. You can burn about anything. But I guess traditionally we've used HTPB because it's well known. It's been used in solid rocket motors for years, and it was just a natural progression to say, let's leave the oxidizer out and make some rubber motors and build hybrids. I mean, that's how we evolved to that.
How come NASA doesn't go to hybrids for any of its launch vehicles?
Well, I believe that the hybrids have their limitations. You know, give you an example. When you burn a hybrid, it's not uncommon to have 2 or 3% of your fuel left inside the motor case after you've cut the motor off. So that's just extra mass you're carrying to space. That is not buying you anything. It's just a characteristic of most hybrids. Another thing is, they for years they've had this combustion stability problem, with LOX. There's been various solutions. You know, some folks use pyrogens up in the front end to vaporize the liquid oxygen, and other folks try to use little hybrids at the front end of the motors, and it just becomes a little more. It becomes more complex. Another probably big reason is the density impulse, like we talked about before. You can't you can't beat a solid rocket motor on a, you know, for strap-ons and for big boosters. There are manufacturing issues and transportation issues, but it's hard to beat the performance of them. And I believe NASA, you know, they know that that they have to have, you know, they have to have some very high performance propellants. Now, if they had some strap-ons that they were going to drop off a few years ago or many years ago, they did some studies of instead of SRBs, solid rocket motors, they were going to use hybrid motors. They actually did quite a bit of studies. I've read some of these, and they were seriously entertaining the fact that maybe we use big hybrids to do this. And it just never, you know, especially after the accident. Basically, you know, after that starts happening, you're not going to make any changes to the manned space program. So basically, they backed away from a lot of that.
Marshall, you still with us?
Yeah.
We got another break coming up. See what you can get out there for Tim prior to the break.
Let's try the short one. On long space voyage, the current fad is the ion engine. Is there any version of the hybrid engine that can compete with an ion engine in long-duration spaceflight?
Did you get that, Tim?
Well, I'm going to have to get you to give me a little more interpretation there.
Okay. He says that currently there's a lot of talk about ion engines. So is there any type of a version of a hybrid that compete with an ion engine for long-duration space travel? And ponder that one while we do our break. We're coming up on it. We'll be back in about 2 minutes. Our guest today, Tim Pitt, and welcome back to the Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Tim Pickens. And Marshall, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Okay. Tim, his question was about the hybrid as a competitor to an ion engine for deep space travel.
Well, that's an interesting question. I've never seen a comparison of, you know, basically in the past, ion engines, they've been tailored. You know, they're very small in terms of their thrust. Their IFC being very high. They're typically, you know, they require quite a bit of power. So I don't know. You know, that's a good question. I don't know what you know. Some of these ion engines, you know, deliver IFPs in excess of, you know, 1,000, 2,000 seconds. And, you know, these hybrids, even a space hybrid, you're going to do good to probably ever exceed 350 ISP, unless you really go with something really exotic and dangerous, what it usually entails. You know, these go hand in hand. So, I don't know. That's a good question. I'm going to have to think about that some more.
Not likely, right?
Probably not.
Okay. Marshall, you have a third question and your last one.
Yes, sir. Real quick. The space shuttle engines use hydrogen and oxygen, which makes basically water.
Mm-hmm.
Spaceship One's engine, you know, uses a lot of exotic materials, and I even understand a few chunks of the rubber came out of the back end. Can you make a really clean burning hybrid rocket engine?
Well, yeah, you get byproducts, you know, you get some CO2, you get some water, you get, you know, it's basically, if you, there are better oxidizers than nitrous as far as if you want, a clean byproduct, you know, the liquid oxygen would be a better candidate. It's just that some folks who are not comfortable, you know, working with those systems and the cleanliness issues that surround, say, liquid oxygen, they're basically something like nitrous is just very forgiving, and yeah, there's some, you know, other than some CO2 and a few other little small particulates, it's a pretty clean burning system. So, I mean, yes, you can make cleaner burning hybrids, and I'm sure you'll see more of that in the future. I don't think the hybrid vehicles are going away anytime soon. If anything, I believe the success of Bert's project is probably going to make people take a serious second look at them and should see that there are some applications that the hybrid is very well suited for. So the answer is yes, and you'll probably see it, I'm sure, in the near future. Some cleaner burning.
Stay into the phone, Tim. You're falling off.
Okay. Yeah. You'll see. I expect you to see a lot better cleaning burning the hybrid propellant combinations in the future. So just stay tuned, I guess.
Okay. Thank you and goodbye.
All right.
Thank you, Marshall. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Tim, I've got a lot of questions coming in by email. Let me put a couple of them out there, and then I want to go back to Orion. Here is one from Jane from my old town of Tulsa, where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, when you stopped working on Spaceship Wind and went back to Huntsville, you were going to start up another XPRIZE team for the XPRIZE competition. Did you do that? Did you have a chance to win? Were you close? What happened with that?
Well, I tell you what, I got back to Huntsville, and I'll tell you, I wanted to be part of, an XPRIZE team. I knew that we had a lot of talent in Huntsville here, and I really wanted to push some ideas I had. We had a lot of hardware, that I had purchased over the years from the defunct, space companies, and I thought, boy, Huntsville's gotta get in the race. That bugged me for a year after leaving out there. And finally one day I said, we got to get in here and do this. Because I looked around and I thought, if Bert doesn't win this, I don't think there are any serious competitors. That's just the way I felt at the time. And based on what I knew. So I really felt like we had a good chance. We had 1 year to pull it off. After we made our announcement. I think we announced in November. And we didn't do it as a stunt. We did it to really get kind of Huntsville on board and get the Rocket City fired up and see where it would take us. We were looking for investors, and we really, our intentions were well. We built the capsule, we built simulator, we built some subscale rockets and flew them based on the escape capsule, and we did some engine firings. We really started diving in, but we really, one of the problems was trying to raise the right type of investment is, investors want to know what's the exit strategy? Where's my payoff going to be? And it was really hard to show when that would really happen. At the time, it was unclear what the FAA AST was going to turn out to be. Who's going to govern this, are we going to be flying experimental, or how exactly are we going to make money at this? Our intentions were, we could build a vehicle, and we could fly people. We thought we had a good idea and a good system that could do it safely. But some of the economics, it was all I can tell you, it was a real learning experience to go through that exercise and to look at all aspects of a business plan, a business model of how we're really going to make business, return money to our investors. And, to some of them, it was very nebulous how this was going to happen. It wasn't just us. We were in the thick of it, and we were trying to really figure out, maybe we'll pick up a payload here and there, and maybe we can make some money and prove to the world that we've got a safe system here, and now we're ready to fly people. But even with all of that, it was there were still a lot of bits and pieces that we couldn't convey a clear message to our investors. So basically, we didn't finish. Obviously, Bert won the XPRIZE, and that was really good for the industry. So. And basically, then Mexico decided, they decided to go with the X Cup to Mexico, and that really hampered our plans for our water recovery. That was very disappointing because at the space summit that I went to with all the XPRIZE guys, we really emphasized how Florida would be more ideally suited, and I guess the money and whatever financial incentives won out, and they went to in Mexico, and so HARC has really have been busy having to re-strategize and decide how they can operate a business like that out of New Mexico. At the same time, offer all the safety features that we thought were important in our Liberator vehicle when we were doing a water-based landing. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, where we've been, and kind of I can talk about more where they're going, but I don't think that is the question.
Let me go to this set of questions, because it goes back to what Orion is doing and what I read about Orion and you in the introduction. This is a series of questions from Bradley in Miami Beach, and I'll just do them all together because I think you'll probably answer them all lump sum here. Bradley wants to know where we can see information on the flyback booster that you propose for Air Force Hybrid Launch Vehicle Program. When are those contracts supposed to be awarded, and do you think you have a good chance to win one? Also, looking at the Air Force Hybrid Launch Vehicle Program information, it says they expect to have affordable, reusable space lift capability by the year 2018, 13 years from now. And that's just for launching things, not people to dock with space stations and so on. So what's the big holdup with affordable, reusable spaceships? Why is it so hard, and what's taking so long? And this should probably tie into what you're doing with Orion.
Right. Well,
and this, again, is Bradley in Miami.
Okay. Well, Bradley, on the 11th of August, I mean July, they are going to make an announcement on the hybrid launch vehicle program, and there'll be probably four teams selected, and who knows who they'll be. The rumor has it there's at least 20 teams that put in proposals, so I guess if I was in Vegas, I'm probably going home empty-handed, but we think we've got a really innovative concept that they're probably going to pay a lot of attention to. So basically, we'll be making that our concept public here in just a few days. If we don't get the hybrid launch vehicle program, what we're going to do is we've got a design for a subscale version of that gets launched underneath a vehicle like the White Knight. And it'll be an airdrop vehicle, and it'll be able to carry a small payload to low Earth orbit using a solid upper stage. But we'll still be able to reuse that booster. It'll actually fly back and land. We've been talking to the Texas spaceport folks about that, operating in down the Brownsville area.
But they don't have a spaceport yet, do they?
Not yet, but they're probably one of the most serious states out there right now. When I went and talked to Governor Perry's folks about 6 months ago about operating out of Texas, and basically they do have some incentives to bring folks with real business plans that make sense, that require minimum infrastructure to get them in the space business. At the time, Bezos hadn't made his announcement yet. It was I was there a week before he was. And basically they said, your plan makes a lot of sense. You do an air launch, you take off from a runway, you go down in the Gulf, you do your launch, and it's horizontal payload integration. This makes a lot of sense. We like what you're saying. Space tourism, well, it's kind of nebulous right now. We can't get our hands around it. We weren't pitching that. But we did. It was Orion went as well as HARC. We both went over there, looking at both the payload side of it as well as the manned spaceflight. And it was clear at that point they were not real interested in doing manned-supported efforts. Okay?
Uh-huh.
I formed Orion to focus on some key elements of space vehicle development, if you will, being propulsion and systems associated with that. And also, it was a more serious effort to, like I said, to focus on key areas, because there's some folks in the space community that aren't quite ready for manned space interpersonal space travel, if you will.
I think you're being a little polite, Tim. Can you restate that, please?
There are some folks in the space community that don't think this industry will ever spool up from a private standpoint. Not being me, by the way. I do believe it'll happen, but, you know, when they see things like, you know, you wouldn't want to show them, like, for instance, I built a rocket belt that flies on, you know, hydrogen peroxide, and you wouldn't want to put that on your website. You might not want to put a rocket bike on your website. You might want to put a rocket car. Let's say you're doing a Lansby car. Whatever you're doing, there's some folks that aren't ready for that. But in the meantime, there's a lot of key areas that we're focusing on that'll help support those areas. But we just hadn't come out of the closet yet, if you will.
That's a great term for me being here in San Francisco.
Okay.
So, all of us in the Bay Area know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's a series of questions. They're written in a way that's very politically incorrect, and I'm not going to go down that road. But I'm going to sanitize it a little bit, and they're from a couple of people. But I'll just use one, and it's from Kenny in Davenport, Iowa. And basically what he's saying is that you worked in the Mojave area. You're really familiar with all these companies. Why is there so much backfighting, mistrust, refusal to work with one another on the various Mojave companies? What goes on in this small fledgling industry where you have so much stabbing of one another behind the scenes in the alt space business?
Well, I think part of it, you got to remember, there are some groups in the desert that for years they've been their space romanticists, if you will. You know, it's either we're going to do manned space flight or bust. And in search of the Holy Grail, if you will, they end up finding that that within itself has traditionally been a hard road for getting a good, a serious business investor, if you will. I mean, that has been a tough road to sell. And they've gotten angry and bitter. This is just my perspective, because I certainly know a lot of these folks you're talking about.
Yeah, and you've been there right in the trenches with them.
Right. And I believe, and a lot of folks have gotten money, and, you know, and other folks that sit there and watch that, they always think they can do a better job, and the other guys are a bunch of shysters, and they're all out stealing from the government. And the fact of the matter is, if you're in the trenches with these guys, they believe in what they're doing, and they all, you know, and they're building hardware, they're doing things. And it makes a lot of sense, but to the outsiders, because they don't have any savvy or any vision beyond either manned space or bust, they get very disappointed. They think there's a conspiracy. it's a little crazy. And this is just my perspective. I'm just telling you that I believe that, you know, these folks don't. A lot of them don't have the business savvy to get out here and really understand how to get a serious business going. And give the customers what they want and what is sensitive. In other words, you can go out and if you want to do a manned space business, you know, and you don't have any investors. Unless you are a .com guy, you're going to have a hard time staying in business. So you can either shift gears and find out what industry needs, and you can, you know, and get as close to your product as you, in other words, wherever you're wanting to go someday, when it's manned space flight or whatever, if you want to develop engines for the government or industry that can someday be used for your manned purpose, then great. But you may not want to be telling the world right now what your true intentions are. You may not get funded. So you kind of have to play this game, at least for a while. It's not as not as much of a game since Bert went out here and showed the world that the small guy can do some really cool things with a little bit of money. But still, there are a lot of cynical people out there who are still skeptical of a small guy doing any serious space efforts down the road. So I believe what we're just seeing. I think we're just seeing a bunch of infighting because there's folks out there starving to death. It's not just Mojave, it's everywhere. The small guys are all wanting to go to space, go to space. But in the meantime, they're not getting out here getting contracts related to things that could support them going to space down the road. They're just focused on the end game and, or else. And I just believe that it just leads to, that's kind of why I'm switching gears here. Hark's focusing on the manned space flight, and I'm sitting here switching gears and focusing on some products to support. You know, like I said before, I wanted to sell shovels to the miners. I don't necessarily have to be a miner today. But I do want to sell shovels to the miners. And hopefully someday I'll be a miner, but I want to see where the gold is first.
Kenny does mention companies, which I'm not doing, but, you know, when he says, you know, they won't do business with one another and they're all located in Mojave, there is an assumption in his question that these companies all should be doing business with one another, but we don't assume that Ford and General Motors are necessarily going to be doing business with one another. Isn't it a faulty assumption to think that just because all these companies sort of are in the same business and they're both and they're all located in Mojave, that, I mean, why would you think that they should be doing business with one another?
Well, I don't think necessarily they should be. I mean, this is competition. This is
right.
Market. I mean, this is what makes us great. I mean, if you're taking away that from individuals, then you've got no incentive to do your best or to be innovative. I mean, that's what drives our economy up.
Yeah, I think that's a faulty assumption.
So, I mean, it sounds real great that we're all holding hands, sing kumbaya to space. But in the meantime, you know, there's just not enough money to spread around to support everybody. And, that's why they are fighting. You know, it's like little crumbs. They're out here, they'll kill each other for a crumb. And this is a competitive business, and excuse me for a second. And it is unclear yet to most of these little companies how you can make a good living at this. If you want to say, well, what about Orbital? You know, small guys started a company, you know, or guys, and now they're doing well. Well, that's not a good example of a thriving company. You know, their intentions were good in the beginning, but ultimately, the fact is the launch that, you know, they only have one customer or two, and basically it's very expensive to launch, let's say, a Pegasus. So, I guess. Some folks are just very overprotective of their intellectual property, and they're also just, they don't trust each other. And it's unfortunate. You know, and Bert and I, we went and visited a lot of rocket companies when we were doing surveying for hybrids and liquid motors. And basically, Bert concluded, he said, boy, you rocket guys are just proud of your stuff. Every one of you think you're the best, and everybody else sucks. And he was right, and that's the way it is. And everybody thinks they're just the god of rockets, and anybody else you get to do it, it ain't going to get done right, and you're stupid if you're going anywhere else. So there's a lot of pride in this industry, I don't know. I think it's one of the problems too is we've got a lot of these companies where engineers are running the companies. And they don't quite have the savvy and the persona to be out here working with people, you know, just doing some handshake deals. I'm learning it's a pretty brutal business.
Here's a question from a chat with Jeff in the United Kingdom near London. And he says, bearing in mind President Bush's proposal, is anyone considering commercial spacecraft production on the moon using lunar materials and launches?
Well, I don't know about commercial. You know, there's a lot of efforts. I know a lot of folks here in Huntsville who are doing a lot of studies using the lunar regolith and how we might, you know, build various structures and and you know, how resources, when resources could be used to build a, you know, electromagnetic rail launchers and this and that. But you know, I really don't know. You know, some folks say that George Bush is an old man and he knows the economics and how important resources are, and he knows there's helium-3 there, and you know, we're going to mine the helium-3. But you know, I haven't I'm not sure that is indeed the case. That sounds pretty grand to do that, but I'm not sure that that's in the sights right now. I don't know anybody who believes that right now, but I have heard something to that effect. You know,
I've had just a handful of guests on the show who proposed that, but the vast majority of people in the technical world and who really know about this, you know, all throw cold water on that.
Okay.
So, and I tend to, you know, have the same thoughts on that you do. I think we've got another caller. Caller, are you with us?
Oh, yes, I am.
And your first name and where you're from?
Oh, this is John from Sacramento.
Hi, John. How you doing?
Oh, doing real good.
You got a question for Tim?
Yeah. Tim, is Ryan going to be focusing just on vehicles, or are you considering, you know, selling them a line of motors separately, you know, like a COTS line of motors people can buy?
Well, I'll tell you, and I've worked for a lot of little companies over the years, and when you have small rocket companies that come out and say, we're going to build big vehicles, everyone I've ever seen do that usually goes broke trying to do it. And so I've decided that I would focus on propulsion, ground support, and testing, and build a real foundation. You know, everyone, during the XPRIZE, everyone said, hey, you know, it's all about propulsion. This is the key to making it happen. And that's been my interest for years, and that's where a lot of my experience is, so it just was logical for us to focus on that. You know, we don't have a product line where you can just go to the website and say, I want a 20K engine, and I want a couple of valves and an igniter, and that's going to be, you know, $400,000 or whatever it would be. And because in this business, it's not a cookie-cutter business. And so many times we've worked with some customers who wanted to treat it that way, but very soon you get into it and you say, well, you've got speed system, we've got to control it, we've got certain requirements for valve actuation times and da-da-da. I think we're going to have to deal with a customer, you know, per customer basis of what they need. Now, when it comes to something, say, as simple as an RCS thruster, we do have some products that, that we could sell you tomorrow. You know, whether it's some cold gas thrusters, we're working on a mono-propellant nitrous thruster. We're working on some self-exciting, igniters that are automatic auto-ignite. You know, we've got some products. So we're working on a 100-pound thruster GOX methane for the CXP program, the T-Space company. So we do have some products that we could sell out of a catalog, if you will, but some of the larger motors, we're not at a point where we could probably give you, it'd still take me a couple of days to put a serious quote together if you call me tomorrow to articulate all the details of what you would need and what type of support you might need.
Because, you know, I buy maybe 4 to 5 motors a year, you know, in the, you know, small motors in the 50 to 100,000 Newton class.
How many
rockets have been around for 2,000 years? Everyone.
John, he can't hear you very well. Can you repeat that?
So that, you know, on the buyer side, you know, I purchase maybe 3 to 5 motors a year, but on the small side, you know, 50 to 100,000 Newton seconds. Yet even though rockets have been around for thousands of years, it's still a custom deal every time.
Well,
but I understand the seller side because there's not enough buyers out there.
You're right about that. And, well, there's some motors that for instance, we build a lot of regeneratively cooled engines. We actually have two wall engines, and we have tooling to build 12K engines, you know, up to 20K, and then we have some tooling to build some 50K LOX kerosene engines. But if we went to something, let's say you wanted a 100K engine, we don't have the tooling. We'd have to make some serious tooling investment to get ready to build your product, your engines. So there are some things that we could quote you and deliver on in a pretty definite finite period of time, but there are other, you know, but if it's something that we haven't done before, we don't have any test data and we don't have any tooling.
Hold it a minute. We're breaking for leaving the Seattle station. So both of you hold on. We'll come back on the other side in just a minute. And to our Seattle-based listeners, thanks for tuning in. If you can switch over to live365.com, you pick it up, please do. You can get the direct link off the Space Show website at Listen Now, or pick it up on archives. And Tim and John, hold on. We'll be back in just a second.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back to the program. This is your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Tim Pickens, and we have a listener, John, on the phone involved in a discussion with Tim. So, John, you want to finish up?
Oh, just want to wish Tim luck with the business. Whenever he comes out to Sacramento, you got to say hi.
Okay, John. Well, I appreciate that, and we'll need all the luck we can get. I think we're off to a good start here. I've been real pleased with the we've been very fortunate to have folks like T-Space and Air Launch as our primary customers. So we're very pleased to be part of the Air Launch and the T-Space team. So hey, keep our fingers crossed, okay?
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Tim, I got another question for you, and I'm going to sanitize it as well. Because I'm not so much interested in the company that this emailer is talking about, but I personally don't know anything about this technology. And so when I got the question, I thought, well, God, I'll ask the question because I want to learn what the guy's talking about, because I'm not as strong as I'd like to be on the physics and the technology. So we can sort of forget the company involved, and if you can, just explain what he's talking about. He says, Rocket Plane is now trying to do a pressure-fed liquid hydrocarbon engine. They are also stating that they will do a wet wing for their vehicle. What do you think of the idea of pressurizing the wing to several hundred PSI? Actually, for that matter, what about the entire concept? And they have redesigned their concept with now a twin-tail design. So what is a liquid hydrocarbon engine, and what are they talking about pressurizing a wet wing?
Well,
I just don't know what he's talking about.
Well, what they're talking about is they're probably going to put, chances are they're going to put kerosene in the wings, and, that's been done before. But, and it's been, obviously they low pressure, I guess these low pressure pressurize it on some planes, I'm not sure. Not privy to the details of their program, but when they say pressure fed, they may pressure feed the LOX, they may pressure feed the kerosene, they may pump the kerosene and pressure feed the LOX. So, without knowing the details, I think it makes a lot of sense because their vehicle they want to make it you know, they probably don't have lots of room there anyway. So, you know, as I understand, it's a Lear-based jet. So they're utilizing all the space they have available, which makes a whole lot of sense. And if you say they're doing a wet wing, I'm not surprised. So I think what they're doing there makes a whole lot of sense. And now whether or not, you know, if they have to go to high-pressure tanks the shape of wings, who knows, they might, you know, might get into problems like they had with the some of the past programs where they had odd-shaped tanks like X-33. But I can't say that because I don't know the details. I think they're... But it makes sense if you can make your tank, your wings work for you as tanks. Hey, makes a lot of sense. So that's about it.
Have you been following anything with return to flight and the space shuttle? Are you getting any information that we may not be getting?
Well, of course, I just keep hearing it's go, 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 or bust. But I've been hearing that for 6 months, you know, as we move dates back. But I think they're serious about it, and I think, you know, and it's pretty common daily to see something in the paper about it here in Huntsville. So I think with the Griffin in there, they're just going to fly it and let the rough end drag. You know, it is exploration, and it is dangerous. So hopefully they, you know, they've got it right, and they need to get it back in the air. I think something as complicated as a spacecraft needs to be flown, and I think systems need to be cycled, and otherwise it's like a car setting up on, you know, in the yard. It's with time, it's just going to be more trouble than it's worth. So I think it's real important for them to get back to flight, and we just need to accept that it's going to be, every flight is more dangerous probably than the last. In many respects, because it is, the systems are a lot of, you know, shaking and rattling and rolling, and you know, things are going to break, and you know.
So, would you fly on the shuttle?
You know, I guess I probably would, but it's, yeah, I guess I would, but as more and more flights happen with it, I probably would probably get more scared, you know. So, you know, it used to be 1 out of 100 flights might be catastrophic. Now it's 2 out of 100, you know. I don't know. Like, I'd rather go to Vegas, but...
And you ride a rocket bike.
Yeah, I've done that, but it's very simple compared to the space shuttle, and I'm not operating it near the margins they are, so I've got a lot of safety margins, so it's my own affordable little space program, if you will. We're just not in space, but it's at least I'm getting to demonstrate that hybrids can be safe, and hey, I'm having fun, and bicycles, everybody can relate to that. So it's everybody likes to come out and watch that. So
here's a question that takes us back to your company, Orion. It's by Rebecca in Jackson, Mississippi, and she says, I'm really amazed to hear you talk about the challenges for raising money and doing things in the rocket business. I would think with your track record and your reputation and coming off of the success of Spaceship One and everybody knowing your involvement with that motor, that raising money for your business would be a cakewalk. If you can't do it, how in the hell do any of these other companies think they can do it when they've never created anything, have no track record, and have nothing to brag about or show? And when you have the real McCoy, you find it challenging. Can you explain this to me?
Well, I'll tell you, I guess, well, you're right. I guess the thing about it is it really takes a lot of work to put together a really good business model. You know, it took Burt Rutan over a year to actually, once he found the guy willing to hear him out, it took about over a year to just do the lawyer stuff before I could come to work for Burt. So for a year, we went back and forth in emails. I think he and I went on a couple trips together. He paid for that. And And basically, Bert was working out of his pocket. I believe it might have even been a year and a half. And basically, it took that long for all the lawyers and everything to get signed for me to, for him to say, hey, we've got an opening now. Come on out. So these things take time. You'll notice that some of the companies that have gotten money out there have gotten this plus-up funding. They've got these politicians that run up here to Capitol Hill, and they sit here and they get this plus-up funding because a lot of these folks are just taking care of their districts. And I tell you, I don't think I have to go down those paths right now for the business model that I have right now. I don't need a lot of investment. And when we were doing the Hark X Prize, we did need a lot of investment. We needed it right now. We only had a year to even get the thing going. As I said, we were late in the game. So that was a hard sell. You think about getting an X Prize and say, well, we've got this motor over here, we've got these tanks, and we were doing this and that. But boy, Bert's going to have to, his program's going to have to get pretty far behind for us really to have a chance. Or maybe if some reason he had delays or technical problems, maybe that would be a door for us to come in. But, you know, these things didn't happen. I guess the main folks that are doing this either are dot-com folks or made their money in the computer industry some way or another, or they've gone out here and talked the states into giving them funding. For instance, some states have paid a premium to get these little companies to locate in their states, and they'll fund them. And you're right, there's no prior history of them ever doing any hardware, but they sure have. They've got a vision, and they've got some pretty pictures and some PowerPoints, and it seems that sometimes that's enough to sell. It's tougher to sell that when you live in a space community like Huntsville, Alabama, where they're, you know, every other person you meet on the street is an engineer. You've really got to be technically on top of it. And locally here, there's a lot of folks who are asked to invest on technical ventures. And it's a tough sell, certainly locally. Now, if we went to the level with the congressman and tried to sell our state, you know, through a tax credit or whatever, that may be an avenue, but we just didn't have time to do that. Those things take lots of time, and I'll be honest with you, I didn't feel real comfortable even going down that path. I think I can run a business and make a fair profit doing what we do, without having to go out here and ask for a lot of handouts. So that's just my opinion. So that's where I'm coming from. But sometimes it takes a lot of money like that to really bootstrap an idea and get it up and running. There are some ideas that I have that on the flyback that I intend to do that with, but I haven't come out of the closet, as I said, yet on that. We'll be hearing more about that when the time comes. But until then, our business model is working for us, and everybody's getting paid and fed, and everybody's happy, and we're making profits. So we're pleased with where we are today, and we'll tell you about future after the 11th.
Has the success of Spaceship One and the X Prize and the new prizes being offered, has that, from your perspective, changed the financial markets, the investment mood, the openness of people willing to consider space investments now?
Yeah, it has. I've seen a lot of new companies pop up. You know, not every one of them is a dot-com, or somebody's out here selling their programs and doing a fair job of it, or either that, or they're just generating a lot of hype in the hope that they'll go out here and find some money. You know, they're making grand announcements and whether we're going to launch in a year or 6 months, and you'll hear more about it. Stay tuned. You know, we hear this kind of thing all the time.
Absolutely.
I'm tired. I'm tired of it. And I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to use those tactics to get business. you know, we're very hardware oriented here, and I think that our hard work will be our testimony, and what you see is the reality, and not the there won't be a PowerPoint. We put our own money in, even our flyback booster concept. We've built some subscale RC models, and we've been flying this thing. But I'll put more money in it. If we don't get funded, we're going to, I'm talking about through the Air Force, we're going to go out here and we're going to fund whatever I can. We will build a bigger version of that on our own dime and prove that it'll work. And it's a cool idea, and nobody's going to, when they see it, they're going to say, that makes a lot of sense. Why didn't I think of that? It's that dumb.
I had Alan Boyle on from MSNBC, and Leonard David came back on a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him what the role of a journalist was in putting out serious news articles that promoted the flakes. And, I guess the long and short of it is that they may or may not know that a company's a flake, and they're really not. Tim, are you there? Looks like I lost Tim. Okay, so everybody stay where you are. We will get him right back on the air. Hang on for just a minute. I'll just continue with what I was saying. Alan and Leonard didn't really think it was necessarily what they should be doing to do the due diligence on the people they were writing the articles about. Let me play some music for a minute while we're getting Tim back on the phone, so just stay right where you are. Listeners, we're back on the line with Tim. We had one of those momentary SBC glitches. So, Tim, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, so Leonard and Alan both seem to indicate that it really isn't the job of the media to figure out who's a flake and who isn't when they write their articles. So, we may very well see and hear much more about news articles promoting or stating companies about to do marvelous and wonderful things when all they've got is a PowerPoint.
Right.
And it is frustrating. Our friend in London, who is on chat with us and asked about making things on the moon, has followed up with what he considers an interesting thought. I'll run it by you. Some meteorites actually land relatively cold, depending on how it breaks up during descent. It would seem that if the heat shield could be made that worked the same way spacecraft could be made safer, the solution has a drawback. The returning spacecraft would require a lot more shielding that burns off during reentry. But if heat shielding was constructed on the moon using lunar regolith, it might actually make such designs more practical. Sending heavy heat shields from Earth is obviously inefficient. The shielding could then be bolted on during the orbital stage. Perhaps this type of solution could be safer because there is less stress on the wings. Reentry is very dangerous due to the heat and high velocities involved. For a commercial company to consider making heat shield using the lunar regolith on the moon, they would want to concentrate on the production problem rather than the problem of how to get their kit to the moon. What do you think about this?
Well, it's an interesting idea because if we're talking Apollo-style heat shields, they were very heavy. They used a lot of silica phenolics and whatnot, and it was very, very heavy. Now if we're talking, and that'll be interesting to see what they use for heat shield for the up-and-coming capsules that they're probably going to be sending to the moon. We're looking at the four-man capsule. It'll be interesting to see if they're gutsy enough to try some of the shuttle-like tile material, or will they go back to a true and tried phenolic, or like you said, maybe they'll
I guess it would be initially a little bold to think we're going to go to the moon and say, by the way, guys, we got to manufacture a heat shield to get home. Hope everything works. But, I mean, obviously they wouldn't do that. But you know, if it becomes regular, it'd be interesting. I don't know some of the characteristics of the regolith in terms of what, you know, what you can make with it. I know some folks that know a whole lot more about that than I do, but it would be interesting if there is something there, you know, that makes a lot of sense. And maybe long term that's a pretty good idea, you know. It's no more than I know about it. It sounds doable to me.
What have you proposed as a replacement for the Delta II? I know you've made some Delta II replacement proposals.
Yeah, and that is basically just the hybrid launch vehicle program. They're looking for a first stage replacement. That's the cool thing about this particular program is the government they're finally starting to say, you know, instead of asking industry to give us a totally reusable vehicle, let's just try to save the first stage. Let's just bring it back however they come up with. Let's let industry sort it out. And that's basically what initially was the Ares program and now is known as hybrid launch vehicle. Is the whole idea of how can you bring a Delta II class vehicle back and reuse it, turn it around, you know, and be ready to fly in 24 to 48 hours without spending billions of dollars. And so basically that's what it's about, and that's what our proposal was about, the method to do this. You know, basically you go up and the upper stages are still expendables and you come back and you land on a runway. You know, the government wasn't interested in doing an ocean recovery. Basically they wanted to bring it back to whether it's Vandenberg or bring it back to the Cape. So and basically they even told us, they said, hey guys, we're not asking for a Mach 15 return from space. We're looking for an X-15, like, you know, Mach 7, Mach 8 re-entry. And so we're going to make it easier on you. And I thought, you know, this makes a lot of sense. And that's where I come up and proposed this, our concept for flyback booster. And kind of interesting, 2 years ago, when I was thinking about XPRIZE vehicles, this concept came up, and I was telling the guys about it out here at one of our nightly meetings, or actually work parties, if you will, the HART guys, and I said, you know, this is what I think would be cool to bring, have a reusable vehicle. And we built a model of it, and we threw it around, and we took some pictures and video, and I said, you know, I don't know if the world's ready for this. And I knew that we were going to be having to raise funding, so I said, you know, we may want to stick with the traditional capsule and do the ocean recovery. So I put the idea on the shelf, and basically, and the government came out with a solicitation. I thought, you know, here is the perfect application. So I was really fired up again. And now, since then, we've done some trade studies. It looks like there's some other areas, smaller than Delta II, where this vehicle could fit. So, irregardless of this program, I think you'll see us going forward, and we'll be looking for opportunities to have some folks that want to invest, or they've got some programs that have a smaller scale version of that. I think we've got something that they're going to see that's really cool and different, and it makes sense. It's very application oriented and very reusable. So that's I guess that's about it on Delta II talk.
Damon in Bismarck, North Dakota, says, "Has your company run up against any ITAR problems?"
No, we, you know, all of our customers are, I've been very sensitive and aware of, the ITAR, the rules of ITAR and, the regulations, and that's why we're probably overly sensitive to what we put on the web, what we discuss, any of the technical details, because, we are very, you know, we're working some programs closely with the government, and we want to
we'll make sure they're comfortable with us, and as a rule, privacy of our customers is paramount, and we're just not a lot of programs we don't discuss for that reason, and so we're quite aware of it, and recently I heard there's rumors that they're trying to get ITAR to extend their reach as far as Australia and over to the English Channel. So I don't know if that's just a vicious rumor, but you
would think they'd want to reduce it a little bit to support commerce.
Well, you think. I'm not sure that they're totally quite. And I'm not sure they quite believe that the space tourism is going to be that significant yet. I think with time, they're going to. I think someday the sleeping giant will wake up and realize, you know, the small guys are very capable of doing some things that they weren't capable of, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And they're going to pay attention, but I think it's going to catch them by surprise. But I do think it'll happen. So we'll just have to sit back and wait. I think there's a lot of exciting opportunities for small companies. And I think more than ever, the government, they're starting to pay attention. I have a lot of folks that in industry and the government side, they come into the shop and they say, boy, this is neat hardware. There's things being built. This is the way it ought to be. You know, we'd love to model our... We need to come observe you for a day. You know, they're just, I think they're a little frustrated, but I think some of the NASA folks are really excited about this aggressive space program that Griffin's got them on, and I think there's going to be a lot of changes going on, and we'll just have to sit back and wait. But I think the small guys are going to have a big role in that. We'll just see.
Okay, we've got, time for this question. It comes in from Robin in Van Nuys, California. And Robin says, when and where will you be coming out of the closet about this flyback booster?
Well, I'll tell you what. If Robin finds herself in Tucson next week at the Joint Propulsion Conference, she'll see some literature on that at the Orion Propulsion booth. We'll be advertising some of our hardware as well as some of our concepts there, but we're not officially coming out with a press release of any sort because it's unclear right now where some of these programs may carry us, but and the sensitivities that surround them. But we definitely will be making an announcement, and I believe that you're going to see, if you don't see a Delta II class flyback system, you're going to see something of a smaller scale, more along the lines of the Elon Musk Falcon class. And we're going to be pushing it, and we're going to be showing the world that there are some cool ways to, very innovative ways to bring things back and reuse them without fishing them out of the ocean.
When do you think we might see that announcement come out?
I think we're going to see it probably in the next week.
Tim, I've got another call on the line, even coming in right at the end of the show. Caller, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
And your first name and where you're from?
This is John. I'm from Montana. Tim, earlier you were talking a little bit about some of the reasons for the backbiting and dissension within the alternative space community. Just how counterproductive do you think that is in the larger arena?
Oh, I think it's pretty significant. I've been unfortunately exposed to some of that even with my company, and I'm not going to name the particulars of it, but sometimes the good old boy handshake isn't enough. If you better. Anything you're going to do in business, you better get it all articulated. You better get teaming agreements up front. You better articulate your piece, your cut, your contribution right up front, because after the money's in hand, people's perspective changes. And if you're a sub, you're way down the food chain. Sometimes you find out you're nothing more than a token and you were just part of a device to help them get a contract. Let's say it may be a Marshall contract, Marshall Space Flight Center. And we just happened to be in Huntsville, and we were just made sense to put us on the proposal. All I'm telling you is I've experienced it, and I'm learning from it, and it's unfortunate. But we just keep looking up and keep pressing forward and just look at it as lessons learned, and we move on. We're not going to break down any of our competitors, but all I'm saying is, caveat emptor, you buyer beware, and business is business, and it seems to be pretty brutal, and the fighting and the fussing, I want to avoid that, but we're going the best of my ability. I don't want to get in the middle of all that kind of confusion. It just wears me down, and it keeps me from focusing on the fun stuff.
So you're taking the high road.
Yeah, you got it.
Rick Tumlinson actually made that same plea at the Space Access Conference back in Phoenix the end of April, to stop this backfighting because it was so detrimental to the industry and the companies at large, and to start taking the high road. But I don't know if Rick or your comments are being taken to heart yet.
Well, I'm definitely trying. I'm going to stay positive and keep looking up, and I'm going to keep my eyes on the horizon. And I'm not, this is the reason, I don't spend a lot of time. You don't find me out here on the chat rooms and the billboards because, I'll tell you, if you're running a business seriously, I don't think you have a lot of time to do that.
Amen.
And I don't, it sucks the life force out of me.
Amen.
I'm working 70 hours a week, I think that's what it takes, and it'll pay off, and hard work will prevail. I think good will prevail in the end, so we'll just keep pressing forward, and we'll stay focused, and folks will someday say, hey, where'd they come from? In the meantime, we're not going to be doing press releases every day for every time we get a phone call or have some deal that might happen, or when we talk to NASA, some folks do press releases every day, it seems.
Absolutely.
They put them on their website, and you think, wow, this is over the top. This is why are they, and it's pretty obvious that they're out here just trying to attract investors, and it's just ridiculous. And I'll tell you, there's been a lot of folks, I've been unhappy with that type of way of doing business, and I'm certainly one of them, and some very famous folks we know are sick of that type of activity as well.
Well, I think it's a great way to end our show today, Tim, with a claim that the high road works best, because I certainly concur with you, and that's an important message to get out to everyone in this community. I mean, the very fact that I had to sanitize questions coming in because they were attacks on companies is ridiculous, and I shouldn't have to do that. So the high road works best, listeners, and talk about yourselves and not down about others.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. I tell you, at the very least, hopefully folks will understand a little bit more reason why this industry is as squirrely as it is. I mean, I sat back and really tried to understand what the heck is going on, why the infighting and all that. And eventually you got to say, I just got to focus on my...
On your own thing.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Tim, I wish you a lot of luck when you're able to come out of the closet and make these important announcements. And I look forward to seeing you down the road and to having you back on the show later on.
Okay, Dave. I really appreciate you having me on. And I... look forward to coming back.
Okay, and Space Show listeners, on behalf of our guest today, Tim Pickens, and myself, we wish you a great week. Come back on Sunday if you all have questions about what the AST is doing, how they're regulating, who gets a license, how you get licenses with or without vehicles, the whole thing. George Nild will be on, and he is the associate director for AST. So this is your chance to hear it all and ask your questions. Thank you on behalf of the Space Show and our guest, Tim Pickens.